I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about housing challenges and inequalities in Greater Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Purnell, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, Jim Morris, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to be talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in the greater Indianapolis area. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Chris Purnell, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, Jim Morris, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to start with you, Amy. Give me an overview of what the housing situation is here in Indianapolis, and then we're going to drill down from there.
So a couple quick stats is first of all, there are two different levels. One is, of course, the rental market, and then you have what we call the sales and lending market within there. And I think focus today will probably mostly be on that rental side. And here in Indiana, we are certainly struggling with the issue around evictions. There are almost 32,000 evictions per year in the state of Indiana. To give you an idea, that's roughly 86 per day. And Indianapolis itself was ranked in the top 50 of large cities in the country because of our eviction rate. And then you couple that with the work that we do around housing-based discrimination, where people are shut out of housing or treated differently in housing due to things like their race, color, gender, disability, national origin, religion, or presence of children.
And all that of which adds, should be illegal.
All of which are illegal, yeah. But yet happen, unfortunately, in our community. And there just are a number of Hoosiers in central Indiana that are facing significant housing challenges.
So, and is this, I'll go to Jim next. Is this on the increase? I mean, are we seeing a spike in this, or is it a persistent long-term pattern?
At least from the work that we get to when we walk with the families that come alongside Habitat for Humanity, it's been a long term. This hasn't been anything that hasn't been persistent. But to Amy's point, some of the statistics are staggering. So part of the role of which we play in trying to bring some relief in that area is the stability that once somebody's in stable housing, whether through ownership, through something like Habitat for Humanity, or the ability to have stable rental housing, that produces impacts that are incredibly healthy and valuable for that family in so many ways.
So 86,000 per year for the state of Indiana. If I'm understanding...
32,000.
Oh, I thought it was
86 per day.
86 per day. 32,000. So that's a good-sized community all by itself. Then that would be a good medium-sized community, probably a county seat in some, in some places here in the state. Okay, so then, Chris, how is this happening if all of, you know, the kinds of things that that Amy's talking about, where people are being denied or discriminated against on the basis of race or ethnicity or gender or religion, how is it happening if this is supposed to be against the law?
Yeah, that's kind of the million-dollar question, right? A lot of times there are certainly bad actors who are just deciding not to abide by the terms of the law, and that's why it's great to have organizations like the Fair Housing Center that are able to come alongside those homeowners slash renters. and provide them the advocacy that they need. But a lot of times it's the way that the legal system is structured that makes it so that eviction is much, much more likely to happen. I'm a lawyer, so everything I see is it's got to have some kind of legal tentacle, right? Which is sometimes myopic, but I hope it actually helps too. But one of the things that we've noted is there are structural, systemic things in place in Indiana's legislation regarding the relationship between a landlord and a tenant that make eviction kind of go on roller skates, sometimes even like on rocket roller skates. I mean, it just moves so fast, and it's different than the way it functions in other states. So for instance, in Indiana, there is a statutory notification requirement that says that people have a 10-day notice before the eviction process is supposed to go forward. However, that is mostly neutered because it does not apply to those leases that actually have some kind of definite end date, which is the vast majority of leases that you have, right? They run from like July to June or something like that. So for most people that are in a lease transaction with a landlord, they really effectively have no right to any kind of notice. And so what the landlord does is just files for eviction. And the eviction process in Indiana lasts about 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, it moves so fast, as opposed to a foreclosure process, which can take up to 2 years. Contrast that with the very progressive state of Alabama, and there is a notice.
Tongue firmly in cheek.
That's right. Yeah. One of the coasts. Yeah. So they actually do have a notice requirement, and their eviction rate is a fraction of Indiana's. And I think that's a piece of the puzzle. But again, there are so many other various factors here as well.
Why is that the case? Why is Indiana? It sounds like Indiana is a bit of an anomaly here. What is it about us? How did we get to a point where we decided we wanted to make it pretty easy for people to be evicted?
You know, that's a good question. If one is a little bit more cynical and thinks about politics and power plays and that sort of thing, then one can get to the point of saying, well, landlords just have a stronger lobbying bloc. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. I think there's also an element of thinking that landlords and tenants are equal bargaining partners and that they're both coming to the table with the same amount of power, which we know is absolutely fundamentally not true. But there's probably a deeper level of history here that that maybe someone else can speak to as well.
Amy.
One thing I want to clarify is that there's certainly – we're not saying that there aren't times when there are justifiable reasons for eviction. The problem, though, within our state is the law is so weighted to the landlord's benefit that the consumer doesn't have a lot of options. And these are things that can follow that home seeker around for years and even decades. They're served an eviction, simply served an eviction. It may not have been justified. It may have been in retaliation for calling the building inspector because your basement was, you know, flooding or your bathroom was flooding with raw sewage, and you're served an eviction. Now you go to apply to a new apartment complex. And tenant screening companies are not differentiating between the serving of eviction and an actual justified eviction. And then that family is kept out of that new rental housing just for having been served an eviction.
So it sounds to me we've got two big areas here we've got to explore. First is sort of sounds like somewhat arbitrary nature of the eviction process, and then also once people have been through this, and again, the number of people who go through it every year, it sounds like, is not an insignificant number, 32,000. I got it right that time. 32,000 per year.
That's right.
It sounds like then they're stuck in a situation in which it is very difficult for them to dig themselves back out of that hole. I guess technically you don't dig yourself back out of a hole, climb out of the hole. So why don't we talk first about what could be done to make the eviction process more fair, and then we'll talk about recovery, you know, how people get back on the straight and narrow. And as you're pondering that, I'll invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Chris, what are some ways we could make this process more fair, more equitable?
Yeah, I think Amy's absolutely spot on. Any way that we can possibly slow down the process, and she's absolutely right, there are times when it's good to have a fairly quick and efficient eviction process. However, what happens is you have to balance in the scales of justice. Is this person given a fair right and an opportunity to what we call cure? If they're behind on their rent, do they have an opportunity to cure it? In other states, they have this thing called notice to quit. And that's what I referenced earlier from Alabama. It's a 10-day notice where you have the opportunity to actually cure your deficiency. And you can go to your landlord and say, hey, I got your 10-day notice. Here's the rent that I'm behind on. And so Alabama's eviction rate goes way down because it's just opportunity. But contrast that with Indiana, where the landlord, their only real remedy is to file for eviction. And so they're using eviction as a debt collection practice, which if you think about it, that should not be the case. We really just to kind of throw a shout out to landlords to sympathize with them a little bit, they really don't have a whole lot of redress there. So what they have to do is file for eviction, which then could lead to attorney's fees because they're in a court process. They have court filing costs. It takes time. And oftentimes, we've been in situations at the neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic where our housing attorneys will show up to court and the tenant will think, okay, I've got my rent. I hit a momentary roadblock. Now I'm ready to come current. And they'll come with what they think is enough to bring the rent current, but it's not because they haven't tallied up the attorney's fees, the court costs, the time. And so eventually it leads to an eviction, even though they should have had an opportunity. So I think Indiana thinking critically about a notice to quit statute, giving people an opportunity to cure, is really pivotal. And in my mind, it is low-hanging fruit and honestly is meant to kind of correct the walking back that happened when it essentially neutered the statute that already exists.
We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in the greater Indianapolis area. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Kim has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi there. I wanted to address an issue where if you moved out of an apartment or a rental property and the landlord keeps your security deposit and states that you have damages or charges and those kind of things, there are specific rental property companies who, I know this from people that are insiders, that make it a practice to do whatever they can not to return security deposits to people and even overcharging them when they're leaving without giving proper notice. And I had a situation where they claimed that there was water damage in the bathroom, which I had no idea that there was water damage under the tile, under the floors in a building that was built in the 1800s. And the landlord was trying to charge me for it. This was a government subsidized home that it was income based. So when my income went up, my rent went up, and I was basically told by the property manager that he really didn't want people that worked, that actually lived in the building, because he made more money off of people who didn't work, who they were getting that subsidy every month. And then, but these are also a lot of times people who don't complain about things like roaches and, you know, structural damages because they're not paying full rent. And sometimes that mindset is that, you know, I'm living somewhere for free. And so, and the only thing that saved me in court, the landlord actually took me to court, but he did not notify me within the amount of time to say that, you know, you're being charged damages. So I found out after I got to court that he was trying to charge me damages. So it was my onus to prove that the landlord had the forwarding address.
Kim, I'm going to step in because
he had the forwarding address.
Kim,
because he sent the notice in the court. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry to step in on you, but we're getting coming up on a break, and you've raised some really good points here, and I want to give people a chance to respond right away. Thank you very much for sharing your story and your examples. Chris?
Yeah, Kim, so sorry you had to go through that. And this will not do anything to assuage what you experienced, but that is not an uncommon practice for sure. We find that landlords and companies that operate in sometimes what are disenfranchised communities or low-resource communities or whatever it is, they have a tendency to not refund people's security deposit because they don't think that they'll do anything about it. But you're absolutely right. It sounds like your judge did a little bit of digging on his or her own and discovered that you do need to get notified. But that's one of the things that maybe the listener should just know, that if the landlord wants to make a claim for damages that that happen during a person's tenant experience, they have to provide within 30 days notice of what those damages are. And if they don't provide notice, then they have to remit the security deposit to that tenant. So it's one of the really, honestly, tenant-friendly things in the Indiana statute, and, which is pretty rare.
We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in Greater Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Purnell, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, Jim Morris, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or track us down on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about housing challenges and inequalities in Greater Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Purnell, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, Jim Morris, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center. So right before we went to the break, we kind of had to rush through. We had a listener named Kim call in who really brought up some great issues and points about, you know, we've talked about the eviction process. She talked about sort of, it sounds like some pretty predatory business practices where some landlords connive to hold on to security deposits or run up charges for damages. And Chris talked about some of the options people have in dealing with that. But there are other issues of, you know, and if you are a tenant and you are in housing that is not safe or unclean, you know, the example she used of roaches and rodents mm-hmm. and all of that, are there protections in place? Are those sufficient? And how do you access them? I'm going to start with Jim first, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think what we've seen, and that, and we've actually got a buyer in our program that's going to become a homeowner this year named Phyllis, who's got a heart condition, and her son has spina bifida, and they have just that, rodents, no central air conditioning, they've got leaks, all things that have not been able to be fixed. So she's looking for some way to have a home that is not only stable, but she can have some relative independence for herself. So coming in and having ownership as being a part of that through our program was a way for her to get out of that. Because a lot of times what ends up happening is they're stuck in a situation. She can't actually afford to go anywhere else and or is forced to live in this type of a condition based on her income level and where she is health-wise. So that puts her in a very, stuck situation that she can't actually maneuver out of and have a more healthy lifestyle, which then ends up otherwise costing her more. So that's just an example of what can tend to happen for those who are in those kind of poor living conditions when they're in rentals.
Amy.
So Kim raised a lot of issues within her call. And to throw a couple more stats at you, we have a significant affordability crisis here in our community. You have to work 86 hours per week in order to afford a standard two-bedroom apartment if you're making minimum wage. And 46% of Hoosier households are considered cost burden, meaning that significant amounts of their income goes toward paying housing-related costs within that. So then you get in a situation where you might not be able to get into what we call traditional rental housing because you can't pass the background check, because you might have been served an eviction once before, or you may have a bankruptcy on your record because you were foreclosed upon, or you may be undocumented, or any variety of different reasons related to that. You're now priced out. You're taken out of that mm-hmm. market, regardless if you could afford it. And a lot of families are kept out because of affordability. So now you finally get housing, and the roaches and the rodents are coming in. And if you complain, you lose what housing you have and where else do you have to go. You can't afford a new security deposit because you won't be getting your current one back until after you've moved. Mm-hmm. And you're willing to put up with a lot. And I also throw one other stat at you. Several years back, my organization issued a report on levels of housing-based discrimination just because somebody pays their rent with a housing voucher or Section 8. And we found an 82% denial rate in Marion County. So then you put yourself in a situation where you might have a housing voucher. Mm-hmm. And you can't find anywhere else to go where somebody will rent you, even if you are could pass background checks. You can lawfully be denied for that as well. So all of those are reasons why somebody may be forced to stay in substandard housing simply to keep a roof over their head.
Chris.
The law is not friendly to tenants in this area, not whatsoever. We've had several people that have come through our intake process and have said, you know what? There was mold or roaches or the HVAC wasn't working or fill in the blank with whatever kind of habitability issue there was. And they were just wondering, what can I do? And honestly, in Indiana, there's not much of a remedy for a person in that position other than to give the landlord notice that something's going wrong, that they need to fix it. Give them a reasonable amount of time to fix it. And if the landlord doesn't, guess what? Your remedy is to move out, which is really not a remedy at all. Because if you're a person who's like Amy and Jim have mentioned, living on the margins of your economic viability, right? You're living paycheck to paycheck. The ability for you to gather up first month's rent and a deposit after you've been navigating this kind of tortuous situation with your current landlord, it's really not a viable option. And so I have folks that come through our office and they say, hey, I withheld some rent in order to fix some of the HVAC issues, or I withheld the rent because some of the windows were broken, or I noticed that there's some rodents or whatever it is. That's okay, right? The answer is no. In Indiana, there's no right to withhold rent. These are called the distinct obligations between the landlord and the tenant. The tenant has to keep paying rent as long as they stay in the property. For Indiana, if you want to say the property is not habitable, guess what? Your remedy is you have to show that's not habitable by not inhabiting it, which is not much remedy at all.
How much of this, and this is a larger question, but as someone who has covered politics in this state for a long time, there are leaders in this state, there are elected officials who will argue that poverty is basically a self-made condition, that if you are poor, it's because you deserve to be poor at some level, that you know that and there's let's face it, there's a strong element of moral judgment in that as well. How much of it, because it does sound like in this situation, the scales are tilted way toward the side that has money and away from the side that doesn't. Jim, you made the mistake of making eye contact first, so I'm going to go with you. But I can tell Amy wants a piece of it, and I'm guessing Chris does too.
Well, I think there's something in there that you said that particularly around the area of awareness, education, what somebody's perspective might be on this. We do a lot of work, even though what's very tangible in us producing a home and educating and providing a 0% mortgage and then purchasing the home through us. Much of the work that we do is actually through donors and the volunteers. You know, we have 7,000-8,000 volunteers a year that come out and educating them on what the actual demand is, what the need is. And so many are surprised that affordability is a need, like Amy mentioned earlier, and that we're working with a workforce that is the working poor. They're working. They're many, you know, they're actually, and the governor stressed, you know, workforce development in our state. Well, there's a real demand, a real need for workforce housing and having the ability to be housed when, you know, what we heard with Chris, some of the impacts of somebody having to be forced to move or figure out another way to move are, you know, if you have kids in school, now they're moving schools. So if you talk to a lot of the public school systems, they're seeing kids moving 2-3 times during the school year.
If not more.
And so the impacts on education. So as Amy was describing, you start this cycle. And how do you stop that cycle? So I think the evidence is clear. Whatever philosophical or moral position you take, the evidence and the facts are right in front of us in what we're dealing with. And I'd rather work on trying to get to the core of the problem and moving people in the right direction of health than really talk too much about it.
Amy.
So I want to give props to this particular legislative session because two bills were introduced around the landlord-tenant law that we have not seen in previous sessions. And to finally have some attention raised about the need to try to address those disparities between landlords and tenants that's currently in the law. One is a bill, SB 422, that was filed by Senator Bohatchek. This would ensure that, as it was originally written, that if an individual moves into a property and it doesn't meet basic habitability issues, they have a right to get out of that lease. Right now, you don't have that right. You've got to pay rent until essentially a judge lets you out of the lease or the lease ends. And then it also has, Chris has been mentioning today, through an amendment, a potential 10-day right to cure. Another bill, that bill had a hearing yesterday, and we're waiting to see what happens on it. The other bill that I want to give a lot of props to is SB 524, filed by Senator Melton. And this is just a phenomenal bill that unfortunately doesn't appear to be getting a hearing. But we want to raise attention about it because not only did it address a number of habitability issues, the right to withhold rent if there are serious habitability issues, like other states certainly have that right to withhold rent. But it also tried to address the eviction issue we had talked about earlier, in that you can have eviction expungement. If the eviction was, you know, unjustified, or it was a long time ago, or it was simply the filing of an eviction and not actually a court-ordered eviction, that can be essentially removed from your record so that it doesn't continue to follow you around and haunt you. And then it also, that particular bill also had some funds, as we've been seeing on the national level through the work of Matt Desmond and others, of trying to get funds to legal services groups to be in court, eviction court, because that has shown by studies help to stave off an eviction if an individual has proper representation.
Chris, I'm going to ask you to be quick because I've got a full phone bank.
All right. Now. All right. I'll be really quick. Proximity matters. John, one of the words you mentioned was just this kind of idea that there's a moral stain to folks that are going through these issues of poverty. And as a Christian, I don't believe that. You know, we believe that all people are made in the image of God and that Jesus was the one who came the closest to us. And so I think that for those that do have that particular persuasion, it's important to realize that you need to come close to those folks that are not in your tribe, not in your same socioeconomic status, so that we can realize, wait a second, these folks are humans just like I am.
We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in Greater Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or do what a listener named Sarah has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a landlord down in Bloomington, Indiana, and we have our own little set of rules down here, and I have to give, as a landlord, give 30 days notice. And a lot of times I give 30 days notice, and then the renters purposely damage the property, and I can never trace them down again. I just want to say a shout-out to the landlord's side. I recently had someone got evicted, and they owed me four months rent at that point, and they poured cement down all the drains in the whole house. So the other thing is I have a house that's empty. I'm working on. I get someone to move in. They move out after 3 months, and it's covered in cockroaches, and they say, oh, you had cockroaches. And half the time the renters bring it, and a lot of times with the deposit, the landlord, after they move out, the landlord will find that, oh, the fleas all hatched or something. They didn't really clean it, but they think they cleaned it. They left 23 bags of trash in the backyard. So it's just the program so far I've been listening to, I've been getting a little bit upset because it's all towards all the problems that tenants have, which maybe is the name of the program. But let me give a shout-out for good landlords that get have problems because of the renters causing so much problems and not caring for their property. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the call and for balancing the discussion to a degree. I'm assuming that there are, and thank you again, Sarah. I'm assuming, Amy, that there are remedies, obviously, for landlords. I mean, the Fair Housing Center suggests that you're trying to balance things on both sides.
Correct. And Chris has been referencing, you know, certainly some of those here today. But the other thing I'll point out is I think sometimes housing providers get into this mindset that they can't do inspections to ensure, mm-hmm. to check if there's damage being done, you know, to their property.
It's still their property,
it's,
right?
It's absolutely legal for, they just have to make sure they get proper notice and treat everybody the same, not single out particular renters because of race or because of disability or other protected classes. But provided they do that, there's nothing to stop. And a lot of times you're going to be able to catch those problematic renters who don't take proper care of the property and really then cause a bad name for all renters within there. Nobody's saying that every landlord is bad. But what we are talking about in the show is that it's much easier for a housing provider in the state of Indiana to get remedy when a law is broken than it is for a tenant, because the laws just simply aren't in their favor.
Is this a, I mean, are there states where they use systems of arbitration as a first step? Because it seems to me that a lot of what I'm hearing here, and I know we've got some callers who are going to take issue with some of the things that have been said. But as an observer, part of what I'm hearing is that it doesn't appear that there are many places to intervene before things have escalated to a point where it's really hard to arrive at a resolution without a winner and a loser.
Right, right. And I think that there have been experiments that Indiana and Marion County has thought about with housing courts and that sort of thing, where it's a very focused court system that is meant to bring the parties together and do some alternative dispute resolution or arbitration. But it's very difficult to do that when it's not legislatively bound. And I'll say, too, Sarah, you're absolutely right. There does come some times when the landlord can be victimized. I think what we're trying to show is that legislatively it seems like the balance of power has been tipped. And one of the things I love about Matt Desmond's book, Evicted, is that he really does show that this plight is on both sides. You have a lot of landlords that are not large scale with multiple properties, but rather they're just individuals, and they're trying to make a living, and they're trying to do right by their tenants. It really humanizes them very well.
We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in Greater Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, one way you can do it is a way that the Indianapolis Neighborhood Housing Project did, and that's via Twitter. And you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. INHP writes, "Hi, John. As you discuss today's topic, please know INHP, in partnership with Cynair, recently launched Indy's first equitable transit-oriented development fund. It's inhp.org/etod-launch/. I'm going to, if I can, spend that by asking what other resources there are out there for people who are facing housing challenges, and how can they access them? Amy, I'll go to you.
Well, INHP reference, that's trying to ensure and protect some affordability around, I believe it's the Blue Line, and a project that they, you know, have certainly put in place related to that. As much as I can, you know, stress that if you are in a situation where you've been served an eviction, to reach out to a legal services group such as Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic or Indiana Legal Services and try to get some legal advice to make sure you understand what your options are.
And if people – yeah, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to mention, too, speaking of Indiana Legal Services, our cousins, they do great work, and they've provided this – it's probably about a 40-page document that's a guide for both landlords and tenants on what is in Indiana law. How can tenants navigate the situation in a way that's best for both parties? So Indian Legal Services, they offer that on their website. It's a great guide.
And do you have the website, the URL memorized?
I think if you go to their website, www.indianalegalservices.org, they should have it somewhere on that front page.
Okay. We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here in Greater Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Purnell. He is Executive Director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. Jim Morris, who is president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, executive director of the Fair Housing Center. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about housing challenges and inequalities in greater Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Purnell, executive director of the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, Jim Morris, president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greater Indianapolis, and Amy Nelson, executive director of the Fair Housing Center. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Stephen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Stephen, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a great topic. I'm an attorney. I've done a fair share of landlord-tenant law on both sides of it, representing landlords and tenants. More than that, I'm a contracts lawyer, and I think what hasn't been talked about enough is that these are all fundamentally contract disputes. And even though it's heavily regulated and the legislature has a whole lot of stuff that has to be in there or can't be in the contract, a couple things, and I wouldn't want any of the listeners to take what I'm saying as legal advice. Get your own lawyer, that's my disclaimer. There's all kinds of provisions. Now, if you're going to be living in an apartment complex, they're not going to negotiate anything, and they're not going to change those large contracts. If you're renting from a sole landlord, someone who, a house, or they're renting out their own property, they may well negotiate some terms. One of the terms would be attorney fee shifting provisions. If there's a breach of the contract, that both sides get their lawyers, whoever prevails, get their lawyer fees paid. I disagree with one of your panelists said that the only remedy in the event of if it's uninhabitable, you know, I'm signing a contract, I'm renting a property to live in, and you're agreeing to give me certain things, you know, a functional refrigerator, you know, safe and secure entryways, basically a healthy environment. And some of these things are stated and some of them are implied. And I don't think the only remedy is to move out. Although, you know, you may have to hire a lawyer to do this. You can go to court. You can allege breach of the lease agreement. I think you can also, frankly, and it's risky to do this, withhold rent, regardless of what the statute says. And if you get sued for eviction, and before you do that, you give written notice to the landlord. I've asked you to repair this multiple times. You haven't done so. I'm going to give you notice. I'm holding back rent until you take care of this problem. And if they sue you for eviction, then you have a counterclaim and you have a defense to that eviction and you ask the court to hear and give you redress for your grievance. So it's not quite as one-sided as what we've been hearing. It is fundamentally a contract dispute and we need to look to the terms of the contract in order to find resolution and redress. That's all I got.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Stephen. Chris.
Yeah. So, Stephen, thanks for your call, man. And thanks for that legal information and not legal advice. That's good. One of the things I just want to kind of pick up where Stephen left off is that this is a contract. And that is true. And these rights heavily regulated. And I think what we're talking about is these are almost inherently unequal bargaining partners when it comes to the landlord and the tenant. And so the idea that a tenant who, as Amy mentioned, might be coming from a bad lease experience, maybe coming from a marginalized community, is going to be able to sit there and have this equal negotiating experience with the landlord, it's just not something that we see. So the idea of negotiating new terms in the contract, while that may work for some, it does not work for most of the clients that we work with. The second thing he mentioned was the idea of a tenant deciding to pursue a legal cause of action and go to court against a landlord in the midst of a habitability issue. While that is technically possible, it's just not logistically feasible because sometimes it really does make the property uninhabitable. If your HVAC does not work and it is December or January or February, and it's that cold snap that we just had, the likelihood of you being able to stay in your apartment or your house is very minimal. And secondly, the idea that you can go out and hire an attorney when you still need to pay rent. And he mentioned that it's highly risky to withhold rent because Indiana does not have that as a remedy. He's right. It's really risky. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you cannot afford that risk. So the idea of going out and getting an attorney, that sort of thing, is pretty dicey at best.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Deborah. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Deborah writes, good afternoon. Does a rental deposit have to be returned if a lease is broken per lease terms, paying three times rent upon termination by renter? Okay, I guess everyone's pointing at Chris. Yeah. All right.
It's the hot seat. Yeah. So it sounds like the question is it mandatory for a lease deposit to be returned if a lease is broken? And the answer is, and every lawyer will know this, the answer is maybe. It just kind of depends. So if there are issues with the property and that are beyond normal wear and tear, then that security deposit can be used for that. Sometimes the security deposit can be pushed for back rent because the landlord would need to take some time in order to get someone else to come into that property. So the answer is a strong, it depends.
We are talking about housing challenges and inequalities here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Sharon has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a statement more than a question. Just noticing that throughout the city of Indianapolis, there's been this huge boom of new apartment housing. And people like myself are very excited to see it, and we want to take advantage of moving into those places. But the prices of some of those apartments in various areas that you really don't think they should be that expensive are, like where you have rent at $1,200 to $1,400 a month. I'm currently paying $960 a month for a two-bedroom, but I just, you know, you want those better amenities, you want a safer neighborhood, but you just can't get your foot in the door. And it's just so interesting to see how there's not a lot of affordable housing for people who are maybe middle class or lower middle class citizens, where you're just seeing so much upper middle class housing pop up everywhere. And I just don't know if that's been brought up already in this conversation, but I just wanted to make that statement and just maybe just hope that the city will have more affordable housing that's new and exciting for people to, you know, participate in.
Thanks very much for the call and for the question. I'm going to start with Amy on that one, because it really, this alludes to also the question of you know, in some ways, gentrification and driving up housing prices, which, you know, in theory is good for people who've already bought into the market, but for those who are trying to enter it, can create another barrier.
Of course, we want to ensure that there is strong development and that removes particularly blight, and that so that people feel safe in their neighborhoods and have an array of housing options as part of that. And I think, you know, certainly a good case study of that is not only our downtown area, but then in the immediate surrounding neighborhoods within that, where there has been a pricing out of the very people who work in those neighborhoods, particularly service industries, construction, things like that, that they can't afford to live there. The other thing for us from the fair housing perspective is we also have a concern because there's been so much new development, but it's been one and two bedroom units. Where are families supposed to go if they don't want to buy or aren't in a position to buy yet, and they might have a few kids? They're really priced out of a lot of the rental market simply because one and two bedrooms are the only things being developed.
Jim, that's part of the reason a Habitat for Humanity exists, right?
Yeah, I think part of it is obviously Habitat for Humanity and ownership. We're first-time owner, and the caller said $900 a month. And you know, for the working families, we have single mom that, you know, is a social worker. And, you know, she had a husband that came back from the military with PTSD and left. And had she not had family, she would have been on the street. So, you know, came to us, and she's working. And, you know, all of our monthly mortgage payments are $600 or below, including taxes and insurance. So that was a way for her to have affordability and have a home for her and her son. That's one option. We're not the only. You know, INHP tweeted in, and there are other organizations out there that provide ownership. And I think a lot of times the renters don't actually know those options are out there, that there are other options other than renting, because those who come to us or the other organizations, you know, are looking for an opportunity for not only the affordability but the stability. And we can provide oftentimes that ability for them to get into a first-time homeowner situation and be a part of a neighborhood as well as having a stable home.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Paul. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Paul writes, I am an attorney here in Indiana. I was director of a landlord-tenant not-for-profit clinic in California for many years. Upon moving to Indiana, I was appalled at the lack of protections for the tenant. It has been my impression that the Indiana law related to landlord-tenant has been all in for the landlord and remains so. There was an entire book of laws related to landlord-tenant in California and only pages of laws here in Indiana. There seems to be little to no motivation on the part of our legislators to move to protect tenants or to balance the scales to fairness to both parties. So this raises the question, what are some of the states that actually do this stuff well, that have struck a balance where things do seem to be fair and if not fair, where they figure out ways to resolve conflicts before they escalate.
Sure, Chris. First, in response to the email, I'll say a hearty amen, brother. It's tough. And I think people that travel into Indiana from the coasts or, you know, again, from places like Alabama, they'll find that it's really kind of a milquetoast kind of state when it comes to landlord-tenant rights. I will say this. I don't know if there's any particular state that kind of quote-unquote gets it right on the nose, but the way the law is supposed to work is it's supposed to address pretty drastic inequities when it comes to bargaining power. And I think what we've been talking about today is not trying to demonize landlords and not trying to put the veil of sainthood on tenants, but rather saying there is a distinct balance of power that's inequitable. And there are many states that have put together a nice suite of legislative protections in place. This notice to quit, which has a right to cure in it. The ability to withhold rent is another one. I think the ability to repair and then kind of deduct that from your rent is a big deal, and there are about 17 states that have that. There is a right to withhold or have a court escrow rent. So if you are in a position where you don't want to pay rent to your landlord right now because he or she is not really upholding the terms of their bargain, the court can hold on to that for you as an escrow agent. And then if the landlord fixes up what they're supposed to, the landlord gets the money. I think there's some really interesting common sense solutions here that don't strike me as being too drastic or wackadoodle. But, you know, it's just a political will in order to make that happen. And so some of the things that Amy's been talking about, it's a movement in the right direction. And I think putting these things together could really help address those inequities.
If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Elizabeth has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Certainly. I am a landlord-tenant attorney, and while I will be the first to agree that Indiana's laws are definitely landlord-friendly, even though some of my out-of-state clients don't think so, I also heard some things being said by some of your guests that are factually not true. The biggest thing I heard was that the list of damages that is to be sent to the tenant after they've moved out has to be sent within 30 days. That's not correct. It's 45 days. And that is only if a forwarding address has been provided, which I can tell you is very rare for forwarding address to be provided. Also, while I agree about, I don't disagree with having the pay or quit put into the language of the statute, that is basic business practice for most landlords, including my clients. It's much easier to send out a letter that says, hey, you're behind in rent, what are you going to do about it, than it is to send it to me and incur the filing fees and the court costs and the headaches revolved around that. So I would strongly encourage people to take a look at the actual statute, and that is Indiana Code 32-31. It's pretty easy reading, and some of it is a little dense, but I would encourage landlords and tenants to take a look at it and read it for themselves to find out what is going on. I think an awful lot of what has been complained about and the remedies actually already happen, including one remedy that's available to tenants is to call the health department if your property is not in good shape. So that's
all I have to offer.
Thanks much. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. I really appreciate that. And you're right, it's 45 days. Sorry, I misspoke there. Yeah, I think that there's some good things that can happen when people actually read through the statute. And it actually is a fairly decently drafted statute, partly because it's fairly thin when it comes to the number of protections for tenants and the obligations on landlords. And I do think that people could get some benefit from that. I think the other thing, too, is that the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic and other free civil legal service providers, we're dealing with communities that have been marginalized and have not had a whole lot of investment in them over the course of time. And so our constituents, they may not think to do the things that the last two attorney callers have called into. I don't think they're factually incorrect. I'm just saying that when it comes to our lived experience with people on the ground, that is something that is difficult to ask for.
Well, does that also presume, Amy and Jim, that, you know, if your remedy is to hire an attorney, that you have the money to hire an attorney?
Not only that, but also the comment about contacting the inspector.
Yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
In the practical world, that's exactly what we'd want people to do. The inspector would come on. If there's a violation, the landlord would be notified. Landlord makes the repair. Unfortunately, that isn't always the reality. And then there's the risk upon the individual of being forced out or retaliated against. And again, they end up then having to get an attorney or going through that process within it. The risk is simply too high.
Jim.
Yeah, and I think building on what Chris said, so many of the families that we walk with, education is such a big part of this. We can't assume that everyone knows, and there's this great source of understanding of just going to an attorney. Seems like that's exactly what you should do, but as in what we do in teaching people how to become homeowners and what to do to actually be a long-term sustainable homeowner, all the elements that go into that, whether it's budgeting, taking care of, this is now your water heater, not the landlord's. These are things that oftentimes are missed in understanding just the very individuals and families that we work with that are working poor. It's a lot of education that has to go on. And so while there may be areas they can turn to, oftentimes don't know where to turn.
So let's take that. We've only got about 45 seconds left that we can talk about this. I'll stay with Jim and I'll see if I can get everybody else in. In terms of educating people about what their rights and responsibilities are, what's a practical step that we could take right now?
Well, I think Chris and his organization are obviously an opportunity. What Amy does in providing accessibility to what is fair and what is actually the rights around folks, and reaching out and being able to understand some of the basics are one of the first steps. And I think from even some of the callers out there, some of the listeners, understanding that while it may be in their capability and understanding and education to know some of these things, they need to look at it from an empathetic and understanding side of the working families that many of us work with, and understand that that's not always present.
I think that probably will have to be the last word. It's been, other than I would ask, I've still got a phone bank full of calls here, so I'd ask if you'd all join us on our Facebook page to continue the conversation. I'd like to thank my guests, Chris Purnell, Jim Morris, and Amy Nelson, for what has been a lively and informative conversation about housing challenges and inequalities here in Greater Indianapolis. I'm John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.